seemed to have suffered a sudden bout of visibility. "We managed to persuade one of the managers there to turn over account information," Renee said. "Your client profile, or lack of one, caught our interest. You seem like someone whom no one will miss." Renee's eyes gleamed. Clearly he enjoyed this part of the dance. His nose was ruddy, spider veins clutching the edges of his nostrils. It looked as though he'd dabbed cover-up over them. A vain man. "As you'd probably guess," he continued, "there aren't a lot of people you can steal $27 million from without anyone else caring. But you happen to be one of those people." "You assume you have a handle on who you're dealing with," Evans said. "A drug or arms dealer," Renee said. "Everything about you fits the profile. No footprint, digital or otherwise. Conversant in violence. Familiar with detention." He waited for Evan to confirm or deny. When it became clear he would get no response, he continued, "So you worked your illicit trade and made a fortune, if a small one. Fortunes not being what they used to be. And then what? You started atoning for your sins? Wiping out the likes of Hector Contrell? Is that what you're interested in now, Evan? Atonement?" "Actually, lately it's been flower arranging." Renee pretended to smile. "I'm always curious about the ways people fool themselves. In fact, I admire it. I wish everything weren't so bare to me. I'm a straightforward man. I like money. More money than one can make, honestly. So when my coffers needed replenishing, the question I asked myself was, why deal with drugs or weapons and all the danger that goes with them? Why not go right to the source? So that's what I did. I looked for a bank account like yours, built up over years of sweat and toil, but not linked to anything respectable." His skin quivered, the smile finding its footing. Ripe for the taking. He seemed to want Evan to compliment him on this ingenious ploy. Instead, Evan asked, "How did you find me?" "It wasn't easy. Cooperative bank managers are hard to find in Switzerland. But I have a gift for creating leverage." He tasted the word and liked it. "Then came the persistence to even attempt to follow your wires. Most of them zigzagged off into the World Wide Web, ping-ponging around the globe, and then, poof. We were about to give up when we had a stroke of luck. A data mining program matched the precise amount of a particular wire made from your account to an online purchase registered by an auction house halfway around the world that same day." "The katana?" "Yes, your samurai sword. An odd choice of toy. Do you know how many other transactions of $235,887.41 were conducted on September 17th? "None. Five, actually. But the other four were easily eliminated from consideration. Because we had the starting and ending points of your payment, all your magical machinations in the middle were for naught." The smug set of Renee's face brought to mind a Jack saying, "Someone who thinks he's the smartest guy in the room rarely is." Evan made a note to attune his payment procedures by adding a few cents to each transaction in the future. He pictured that gray Ford Transit van springing up in his rearview mirror as he'd neared the Norfolk FedEx office. The same FedEx to which the Seki auction house had shipped the sword. The van hadn't been tracking him. Not yet. It must have been patrolling the block, waiting for a signal from inside that the package had been claimed. Renee seemed pleased by the specifics he held in his plump palm, but everything attached to that wire was cut-bait ready, Evan's bank account was as end-stopped as the Forerunner, registered under a false identity nestled inside a confusion of front companies. He just had to keep his head level, follow his training protocols, choose his moment. Manny must have sensed a shift in Evan's emotions, because he firmed the shotgun to his right shoulder. He was closest to Evan, the barrel no more than 4 feet away. After the fate of his predecessor, he'd earned the right to be jittery. In the back, Dex remained alertly forward on the balls of his feet, his massive body idling, a Mustang waiting for the light to change. He lifted a paw-like hand to scratch his face, and again Evan caught a glimpse of something on the skin. Red and black magic marker? A tattoo? A stitched wound? Evan looked at Renee. What next? Your money in the account is denominated in various currencies, some fairly exotic. Our cooperative bank manager has instigated the necessary transactions to convert your holdings into Swiss francs, my preferred brand. 3 full business days are required for the trades to settle. First thing Friday morning, you will type your codes, send the wire transfer, and go on your merry way. Friday would still give Evan 9 days to intercept Allison Siegler. 9 days was plenty of time. If he had any faith that Renee was in fact planning to let him go on his merry way. Renee couldn't release Evan. Not after he knew what Evan was capable of. Not after he'd taken 27 mil from him. Not after Evan had seen Renee's face. Until then, Renee continued, your life can be as pleasant as you choose to make it. And if I opt for unpleasant? Evan asked. I've never sparked to torture, Renee said. Not like these fellows. He rested a hand on the shoulder of the narco to his left and gave an affectionate squeeze. Evan let his posture deflate, a show of defeat. Then we have an agreement? Renee asked. Evan extended a hand as if to shake. The cartel man shouted in Spanish. Manny reared up, readying to fire. Feigning puzzlement, his arm still extended, Evan took a half step forward. Then he whipped his hand up, knocking the shotgun back over Manny's shoulder. It discharged at point-blank range into the face of the narco behind him, putting a hockey puck-sized dent in his forehead. The recoil kicked the shotgun from Manny's grip. The third narco fired recklessly in front of Manny's face. The round skimmed across Evan's back, trailing friction heat. Disoriented, Manny swung at Evan. His punch glanced off Evan's chin and struck him square in the shoulder, and Evan spun with the impact, letting himself drop to the floor. He threw a leg sweep that caught the other narco behind the Achilles, launching his feet out from under him. The guy hit the floor flat on his back, his breath leaving him in a seal-like bark an instant before Evan hammered the heel of his foot into the man's throat, crushing his windpipe. 2 dogs, 6 guards, and Dex. Through Manny's legs, Evan could see the first narco seizing on the floorboards, saliva webbing from the corner of his mouth. Dex's pillar legs were visible too, rotating powerfully to the doorway. Renee clamped beneath his arm in a ragdoll dangle, his high-ticket loafers skimming the floor. Manny kicked Evan in the stomach, knocking a clump of air from his lungs. Evan fought through the pain and clenched around the boot. Somehow he held on, Manny toppling over, his mouth stretched wide in a grimace, gold teeth flashing. Before Evan could get to him, the room seemed to darken. Dex, blocking out the light, 1 massive arm drawn back. As he swung the pipe down, Evan rolled to the side. The metal end splintered the plank next to his cheek. Flipping over, he grabbed the pipe. Too late. He realized it was a cattle prod. Everything turned a brilliant shade of white. He felt a vague sensation of sliding several feet, the uneven floor sandpapering his ass, his shoulders, the back of his head. The inside of his mouth prickled. His face stuck with 1,000 pins. His body was immobilized, save for the scorching pain still twitching the nerves of his arm. Somewhere he registered sounds of retreat, the bedroom door slamming shut. Lying there on his back gave him an excellent view of the gas hissing through the ceiling vent above, wavering the air like a heat mirage. 13. Last glance back. For Evan's 17th birthday, a former Army Ranger exposes him to a brutal week of sleep deprivation and caloric reduction, then drives him to a desolate stretch of the snowy Allegheny Mountains, gives him a set of coordinates, and leaves him shivering in a t-shirt and jeans. As the four-wheeler pulls away with a cheery toot of the horn, Evan recalls Jack's third commandment: master your surroundings. Looking around, he wonders how this is possible. He has weathered SEER training, which focuses on the four basics of operational up-the-creekness: survival, evasion, resistance, and escape. He's been taught woodcraft and wilderness skills, counter-interrogation and camouflage techniques. He can make a fire, build a shelter, and distinguish mushrooms he can eat from mushrooms that will Cuisinart his kidneys or send him on a psychedelic trip on the magic bus. But now, as he faces the reality of the damp earth and empty pockets, it seems like all that knowledge is for shit. 48 hours later, near hypothermic and bedraggled beneath a paste of mud and leaves, he stumbles upon a long deserted cabin. The roof is partially torn off, the walls rotted, critters nesting in the walls. In a fallen cabinet, he finds an ancient energy bar still in the wrapper and devours it. Mistake. Too late, he notes the bitter aftertaste at the back of his tongue. A gentle poison, or emetic, probably hydrogen peroxide or syrup of ipecac. Curled up on the dusty floorboards, he vomits the scant contents of his stomach. It seems that the heaving will never end. In hour two, he hears an engine approach over the rugged terrain. The door opens, and a shadow falls over him. Why the hell would there be an energy bar in a deserted cabin? Jack asks.
The first commandment, Evan croaks.
That's right. Jack crouches, sets down a bottle of water by Evan's face. See you at home. 4 days later, having staggered out of the woods, cleaned up in a gas station bathroom, stolen clothes from a church coat room, and hitchhiked dog-leggedly back to Northern Virginia, Evan passes through the twin stone pillars and begins the painful climb up the dirt slope to the two-story farmhouse. Strider meets him at the porch, nuzzling his palm, wagging his tail so hard his rear end swivels. Jack is sitting at a dinner table set for two, a steaming turkey in a basting pan set on a trivet before him. He sips a vodka martini, still ice crystal cloudy from the shaker. Evan crosses his arm, winces from the pain. He thinks back to Van Sciver, how when they were kids he always seemed to loom overhead, backlit by the sun, the edges of his red hair turned golden, the bearing of a god. He would have done better. He would have faced the wild fearlessly. He would have known to avoid the energy bar. He would have made it out a day quicker. Or two. Evan feels emotion in the back of his throat, in his nostrils. The words come like broken glass.
I didn't do so hot.
Jack is all rough edges and rugged exterior, but his eyes and the etched skin around them convey something much, much softer.
Next time, he says. Next time.
He rubs his hands, appraises the turkey. It still needs to rest before carving. There's a hot bath waiting for you. Evan nods and heads upstairs. Several years later, on a bleak gray morning, Evan finds himself riding shotgun east on Route 267, a carry-on bag across his thighs. In his back pocket is a real passport with real stamps and a false name. Jack's hands grip the wheel in the 10 and 2, and he gazes straight ahead as signs for Dulles International float overhead. I am the only person who knows who you are, Jack says, what you do. The only person inside the government or out. The only person in the world. This is not news. Evan wonders what is motivating Jack to break character this dreary East Coast morning by repeating the obvious. I am your only connection to anything, Jack continues. Anyone else contacts you, says I told them. Do not believe him. I am it. Okay, Evan says. I will always be there. The voice on the other end of the phone. Evan realizes he is witnessing something he has never seen before. Jack is anxious. Jack? I'm ready. The airport cop flicks a gloved hand, and Jack coasts up to departures. At the curb ahead of them, against the backdrop of a minivan, a teary mother and a stoic father hug their son. The teenager wears a college shirt with intersecting lacrosse sticks. He looks impatient. Evan reaches for the door handle. See you when it's clear. He starts to get out, but Jack's hand grips his forearm firmly, stilling him in the passenger seat. Remember, the hard part isn't killing, he says, not for the first time, or the 50th. The hard part is staying human. A micro-expression flickers across Jack's features so fast that Evan might have missed it if he didn't know him the way he does. Fear. Evan feels his throat constrict ever so slightly. Neither of them is accustomed to expressing emotion. Not trusting his voice, Evan nods. The vice grip on his arm relents. Jack waves a hand at the waiting terminal. Go on then, he says, slightly bothered, as though Evan has been holding him up. Evan climbs out, the chill whipping around his neck, cooling the flush that has crept up into his face. He blends into the thickening crowd entering the international terminal, walking neither too fast nor too slow. A face among faces, invisible in plain sight. The boarding pass rustles in his hand. When he reaches the printed destination, there will be additional orders from Jack, directing him to a man he will kill. He is 19 years old, and as ready as he'll ever be. He gives a last glance back through the big glass doors at Jack, his only connection to legitimacy. He is also Evan's only connection to humanity. 14. Rambo in a bespoke shirt. This time when Evan arced up from the depths and broke the surface of consciousness, he sensed a difference in the consistency of the air. A draft. Rolling his head to the side, he noticed that the bedroom door was ajar. He rose, wobbling a bit on his feet, then made his way toward the door. When he stepped through, he picked up movement far down the hall on either side of him. First he looked left, where Manny waited, shotgun leveled. To Evan's right was another narco, one of the guards he'd spotted earlier from his window, with his weapon also at the ready. Evan took a step toward Manny, and both men moved with him, maintaining the 20-foot buffer. They had learned. Manny jerked the end of the shotgun at the other man. Dígale, Nando. Santa Muerte, tattooed on the side of Nando's neck, looked like she was melting. He swiped sweat from the ink quickly, his hand slapping back onto the shotgun's barrel. Mr. René say he invite you to take some air. He say perhaps you can find some perspective. René's arch tone, replicated through poor diction and a strong Mexican accent, made Evan smirk. Nando flicked his head, making clear that the request wasn't really a request. Evan started down the high-ceilinged hall, Manny backpedaling and Nando bringing up the rear, the three men moving of a piece. The chalet smelled of dust and sweet rot, all the scents of a time-honored place. The space opened up around Evan, such a contrast to the locked and barred room. They reached a landing. Hold up, Manny said. He shot a quick glance behind him, finding the top step with his boot, then looked back and ran his tongue across the caps. Okay,
Slow as shit, Ese, or you be wearing around in your face. Then you need gods like me.
He bared his teeth in something resembling a smile.
Comprendes?
Comprendo. The three men moved awkwardly down a few broad flights of stairs, Manny sliding his hip along the polished wooden banister for balance so he could move backward while keeping the shotgun raised. They reached the ground floor, stepping into the embrace of an expansive parlor. The lush Persian carpet yielded softly underfoot. Evan took in the intricate woodwork, the scattering of billiard tables, the excessively stocked bar. Renee certainly didn't skimp, particularly when it came to luxury. Two foot soldiers sat on leather couches sipping scotch, Kalashnikovs resting on the cushions at their sides. They barely took notice of the bizarre procession moving past them. A hostage being moved at double gunpoint didn't warrant a second glance. Business as usual. Evan wondered how many times Renee had played through this scheme. How much blood had the walls of this chalet seen? Evan paused, adding the men to the tally. 2 dogs, 8 guards, decks. Before Nando prompted him to keep heading down a wide corridor. They passed a library, a sunroom, an empty ballroom with a listing grand piano and a past its prime air right out of a Victorian novel. The grand entrance rose 2 stories, crowned by a glittering chandelier the size of a Buick. Evan leaned back on his heels, looking up. A country rube visiting Kuala Lumpur. Chalet windows filtered in the burnt orange of the setting sun. Manny halted by a curved Hollywood staircase and gestured for Evan to continue outside. Evan placed his hand on the doorknob. The metal felt like ice.
I can just leave?
Manny smiled.
You can try.
And then Evan understood. His thin, tailored shirt and jeans would provide scant protection from the cold. Renee wanted to show him just how unforgiving the terrain was, to dissuade any thoughts of escape. But he didn't need to escape. Not yet. He needed to recon, gather intel, get the lay of the land. And Renee was providing him with a perfect opportunity to do just that. Evan stepped outside, the breeze sweeping straight through him, biting at his ankles, his neck, his wrists. Clenching his fists, he drove them into his pockets. A light snow fell, so fragile that the flakes dissipated the instant they hit his clothes. For a moment he stood on the vast stone porch, giving his body a chance to acclimate. Renee was right to show off the brutal landscape. Seer training aside, without a clear plan, Evan would die of exposure. He appreciated the pageantry. Now he had to bear down and gather as much information as he could. A circular cobblestone driveway received a gravel road that pointed east, the only clear route in or out. The hard earth crunched beneath Evan's hiking boots as he stepped off the edge of the cobblestones, putting the chalet behind him. Pine air whistled in his windpipe, clean as mouthwash. Turning back, he admired the grand exterior. 4 stories of stone and wood plunked down on an apron of landscaping carved out of the hard terrain. Boxy shrubs artfully concealed a few sunken basement windows. A tower stretched up from the east wing, manned by a rail-thin guard whose silhouette Evan didn't recognize. He included the man in his mental count. Evan rotated in a full circle, taking in the sweep of the surrounding range. The valley position was ideal for Renee. A single lookout could monitor incoming traffic from all directions, the amphitheater effect of the mountains ensuring that a car or a plane would be heard from miles away. It made even more sense why Renee had hired Narcos for his detail. Aside from ISIS bodyguards who were unwooable by money, Narcos had the most experience conducting illicit and elaborate operations while staying off the radar. Evan had no doubt that these men had cut their teeth hiding powerful drug lords from the Federales, rival cartel assassins, and DEA drones while doing the legwork to keep the empire running. Procuring these men was ingenious and bold. Renee's trademarks. The air was crisp, the view at postcard resolution. Above the ridge, a hawk caught a wind current, frozen in place like a fleck of paint on a camera lens. The slope to the north looked to be the most gradual, which suited Evan fine. The border to Liechtenstein lay that way. The red barn sat a few hundred yards to the east, two narcos perched on wooden crates by the door, smoking and sipping coffee, their AKs dangling from straps. They wore long dark coats, heavy enough to add bulk. One poked a fork into a plate of food. A fire languished between the crates, down to ash and embers, a pot hanging over it like something from a cowboy movie. Evan recognized them as two of the men he'd seen jogging into the barn earlier. The Dobermans lounged at their boots, resting. Evan started toward the men, and they both rose quickly. The dogs lunged to their paws and issued a rumbling growl in stereo. But still they kept slack in the leash. They were well-trained, not junkyard menaces. The wet air conveyed the scent of cigarettes, onions, and garlic. As Evan drew near, he saw that the plate held a half-eaten tamale smothered in green salsa. His stomach leapt at the sight. Giving the men a wide berth, Evan passed by. Buenas tardes, he said. Buenas tardes. The barn door rumbled open with a metallic rasp. Another narco, with grease stains on his hands and shirt, stepped outside as he lit up a cigarette. A tenth guard. His left cheek sported an impressive knife scar, his patchy beard riding the pitted flesh haphazardly. He saw Evan and froze. Through the rolled back door, Evan took in the exterior. Only now did he realize that the barn, for all its cozy old-world appearance, was built of metal. There were no stables inside, but an open stretch housing a pair of big Mercedes SUVs. Geländewagens with their license plates removed. Beside the G-wagons, a vintage Rolls-Royce Phantom was parked, jacked up on the left side, its rear tire removed. Gear lockers lined the back wall. A distressed feminine voice carried out, ringing sharply off the metal, echoes making her words unintelligible. Evan strained to source the sound, catching a flash of movement between the G-wagons. A woman doubled over, head bent painfully, her mane of straight black hair thrown forward over her face. He couldn't see her features, but the sounds clarified his cries. She slid bizarrely along the ground like a stop-motion insect, one arm twisted up as if in supplication. It wasn't until just before she skittered behind one of the vehicles that Evan spotted the massive hand clamped over her wrist, wrenching the arm painfully as it dragged her from sight. It had a streak of color across the back, just beneath the knuckles. Dex. The man with the grease-stained shirt slammed the door shut quickly behind him, clearly concerned by what Evan had seen. Or was he? Had the whole episode been staged? At a 20-yard standoff, the men regarded Evan, blinking. Then they flicked their cuernos de chivo at him. Get moving. He kept on toward the edge of the pine forest, half expecting them to herd him back toward the chalet. But they let him roam. There'd be no going Rambo in a bespoke shirt on an empty stomach with zero planning. Not in this weather. As Evan hiked through the trees, even the muddy patches held firm, frozen in place. Though the branches filtered out most of the snow, a light dusting still fell, melting on impact. He worked his way up the first slope, sticking to the ridge. The trees were less dense here, providing better sight lines to the chalet below and the looming crest. He paused, breathing hard, his sweat clammy and cold across the back of his neck. His hands were going numb. He spotted a clearing ahead and set up the jagged slope toward it. When he finally reached the break in the trees, he paused, leaning against a boulder. A glass-like puddle at his boots looked like a portal to the underworld, the reflected pines thrusting down to a miasma of subterranean clouds. A loon arced gracefully down to land, kissing its mirrored opposite and shattering the illusion. The sleek black head bobbed, and then a mournful wail drew out and out, warbling the air. Evan would have to head back soon, or risk frostbite. He climbed atop the boulder and peered up the northern face of the range, charting a mental course over the brink. His thoughts traveled to a mid-size carrier that right now was sliding south alongside the Baja Peninsula toward the Panama Canal. 17 years old, locked in a goddamn 20-foot ISO standard container like a piece of break bulk cargo. For a moment, the image of Allison Siegler made him debate going for it, insulating his skin with a paste of mud. Once he got past the rim, he could build a shelter, search out tinder, forage for food. Maybe it was worth taking the shot now. The loon's howl cut off abruptly, and it took flight with a graceless flapping, flecks of water raining down on Evan's head. He turned to see what had scared it off. A 10-point buck had wandered silently to the water's edge. His majestic head was raised, obsidian eyes fixing Evan where he stood. Evan's breath gusted out, wisps riding the air. He could see the buck's breath, too, twinning plumes from the nostrils. The buck lowered his front leg, muscles sheeting beneath the fur. A frozen moment. Then the buck jerked. An instant later, the gunshot thundered across the valley. Evan's head snapped upslope to search out the shooter, but it was too late. The stag buckled onto bent front legs. He wheezed. His hind legs kicked, propelling him forward onto his neck. The puddle sprayed, dark with churned-up muck. Then the buck collapsed onto his side. Crimson matted his fur, running into the water. Evan slid down from the boulder and walked over. Breath fluttered the tattered fur of the wound, air leaking through the punctured lung. The sound like a deep, hoarse sigh. Saliva frothed the mouth. One rolling black pupil looked up at him. Evan squatted over the buck, rested a hand on a warm neck, stroked it gently, until an inner stillness claimed the eye. He tallied the new count. 2 dogs, 10 guards, Dex, and a sniper. He understood better what Renee had wanted him to learn on his little nature hike. Now that the point had been made, Evan was not surprised to hear heavy footsteps approaching through the underbrush. It was time for him to be returned to his box. A moment later, Dex broke through the tree line into the clearing. Still crouched, Evan looked up at him. Dex was expressionless as always, his gaze absent of life. His face maintained that preternatural blankness as he lifted his right hand and cupped it over his mouth. Elbow flagged to the side. Palm pressed to his lips, the V of his thumb and forefinger snug against his nose. For the first time, Evan saw the tattoo on the back of his hand clearly. It was a mouth stretched eerily wide, conveying pleasure, but no happiness. A painted smile slapped monster mask crooked over Dex's actual mouth. 15. Back Alley Philosophers. Renee's sleek steak knife sliced through the cut of venison, juice oozing from the pink center. He skewered the cube of meat on a designer fork and held it out to his side. Dex took it gingerly and deposited it into his mouth. He chewed, swallowed, nodded. A poison taster to the king. Of course, the majority of toxins would take much longer to manifest, but Evan was learning more and more how much Renee indulged his affectations. With its dark woods, brass sconces, knock-off Monet, and silk rugs overlaying a parquet floor, the formal dining room had a somber ambiance, taking itself too seriously. Evan sat at the opposite end of an elegantly set table the size of a small sailboat. He and Renee were the only two dining. Aside from Dex, cast in the role of guinea pig, the sole deviation from the Citizen Kane setup was Manny, standing 10 yards behind Evan with a shotgun aimed at the base of his skull. Renee's eyes flicked down the length of the table at Evan. At last, he spoke. This is proving to be a protracted conversation. He mopped a pink square through the juice pooled at his plate and took the meat off the tines. He closed his eyes as he chewed, then dabbed the corners of his plush lips with a linen napkin. Evan looked down at his setting. His venison had been cut into bite-sized pieces. No utensils. His napkin had no bamboo ring. But the bone china plate would shatter readily, and he could wrap the napkin around the base of one of the shards. Renee interrupted his thoughts. "You have to stop trying to kill my men." Evan said, "Trying?" Renee's laugh seemed to catch him by surprise. When the smile faded, it was as though it had never existed. "Eat," he said. Evan ate with his fingers, the meat delicious and salty, tinged with rosemary. He couldn't remember being this hungry since he was a kid. He'd spent a lot of years half-starved, fighting for every mouthful. Renee looked genuinely pleased that Evan was enjoying his meal. "Would you like seconds?" he asked. "Yes." Renee moved a bejeweled finger to a slender white remote on the table beside him, and a moment later one of the broad kitchen doors swung open. The narco from the barn, now wearing a chef's smock in place of a grease-stained shirt, emerged with another plate of meat, also cut as if for a child. "Careful, Samuel," Renee said. "Right there is fine." He gestured to a spot several feet up from where Evan sat. Keeping a wary eye on Evan, Samuel placed the plate down with a thunk and retreated to the kitchen. As the doors fanned wide, Evan peered through, taking in the huge kitchen with its center island, wood-fired oven, and cavernous pantry. He plugged it into the blueprint of the house he was constructing in his head. He rose, claimed his plate, and returned to his seat. The bore of Manny's shotgun tracked him the entire way. "Look up," Renee said. Evan did. "Smile." Evan stared at him. Renee's eyes peered out through the unnaturally smooth skin of his face. He was serious. "What, Renee? You want to be friends?" Renee pointed the knife at him. "Given your circumstances, is it wise to make me an enemy?" "We're well past that already," Evan said. He resumed eating, letting his eyes pick across the room. European outlet plugs spotted the wainscoting. The knockoff Monet upon closer examination was a Monet. On the east side, the dining area blew open into a cathedral-style living room. Beyond oversized couches and ottomans arrayed like sleeping elephants, floor-to-ceiling windows showed off snow-spotted panes backdropped by the black of night. Evan could see his own ghostly reflection floating in the glass. Even across the length of the table, Renee's gaze felt cold on the side of Evan's face. "You're not a complainer," Renee said. "I appreciate that. It's amazing what people can convince themselves constitutes stress. Most Americans seem to believe that safety assurances are awarded at birth like factory-issued warranties. So far as I can tell, the only American growth industry is entitlement." He settled back, folded his hands across his belly. His suit, made of a thick velvet-like fabric, didn't wrinkle. It rippled gracefully, flowing like water. "For the sheep, moral outrage is the coin of the realm. They smother themselves in it." Evan ate his meat, one pre-cut bite at a time. Renee bristled, his first show of impatience. "Well?" "This doesn't interest me," Evan said. "Why not?" "I've dealt with enough tin-pot tyrants and back-alley philosophers for one lifetime." Renee drew his head back, just slightly, but Evan could see that he was stung. His complexion was bloodless, save for tinges of pink rimming his nostrils and eyes. Despite all his efforts, he looked unwell. His fingers drummed on a blackberry that sat next to the clicker. He peeked at the screen, let it darken again. Since BlackBerry was a Canadian company, many believed that it gave better protection from the NSA. Evan guessed that Rene used a mirror system for his comms, transmitting every text or call through several intermediaries. Only his inner circle would know where he was, keeping him as safe and hidden as a cartel kingpin gone to ground. Rene broke in on Evan's thoughts.
"I assumed you would understand," he said. "After all, we function outside the rules."
"No." Evan thumbed another nugget of venison into his mouth. "I'm the sum of my rules."
"Your rules, perhaps. Not the rules."
Rene waited for Evan's counter until it was clear that none was forthcoming. "There aren't many things I do well. But what I do do well, I do that better than just about anyone. Discerning financial patterns, the ebbs and flows of accounts, reading the digital droppings people leave behind. It wasn't the $235,887 you spent on that sword that sank you. It was the 41 cents. He leaned forward, searching for a reaction. "That's my superpower. I see things in numbers others can't. And I know how to rearrange matters to get those numbers in my column rather than in someone else's. My father, he didn't view that as work. No value add. To him, it wasn't a gift. It was just manipulation. He never saw my talent. In another life, I could have been a director at Goldman Sachs." His smile was a memory, cold as a ghost. "Imagine that. Imagine if there was one thing you were meant to do, and it wasn't acceptable in the eyes of anyone. And yet, it was who you are." Evan thought of the scattering of freckles across Mia's nose, the way she swayed when she listened to jazz, the fact that they had decided, for her safety and Peter's, that he should stay away from her. Rene said, "Whether you want to admit it or not, I can see that you understand me. People like us, we exist out of time, really. The day-to-day wear and tear that grinds ordinary folks down. Cubicles and carpool lanes, earning a penny at a time. Why wade through it all when it's so easy to not?"
"I suppose," Evan said, "that I have an overdeveloped sense of justice."
"Where do you think it came from?"
"I've been on the other side."
"Isn't that interesting?" Rene said. "So have I.
That's what convinced me. Justice doesn't exist." "What does exist?"
"Luxury."
Rene sipped his wine. "You could take silk sheets and caviar and inject them directly into my veins."
"So that's what you live for?"
"I want to have everything I want for as long as I want it."
"At any cost?"
"At any cost to others, yes. Look at me. I'm fat. I'm ugly. What do I have? Money and fearlessness, which equals power. Through power, I get my needs met. I value luxury, yes, youth and beauty."
A young man trudged in from the hall, rubbing one eye with a fist, his t-shirt pulled up, exposing the kind of stomach only achieved in one's early 20s. A slight concavity runged with muscle. His dirty blonde hair swirled up, bedhead chic. He was either stoned or really tired.
"Rene's son?"
Rene stiffened. "It's not safe for you here, David."
David looked around through heavily lidded eyes, taking in Evan, Dex, Manny with his raised shotgun.
"Looks plenty safe to me."
He plucked a piece of meat off Rene's plate, chewed it languidly. Then he leaned over and kissed Rene full on the mouth.
"Oh."
David mussed Rene's perfectly coiffed hair.
"The steam room is broken."
"Broken?" It takes too long to get, you know, steamy.
I'll have Samuel look at it.
You're a doll.
David cast a bored gaze at Evan, then disappeared back into the hall. Renee shared an exasperated look with Evan.
When you're young, you're never going to be old. Remember?
He forked some green beans into his mouth. More wine.
I'm not gay, he said. I just sometimes like to sleep with men.
He pressed the clicker again, and Samuel appeared, scratching at his scar.
Go look at the steam room, Renee said. There's nothing wrong with it, but David's fussing again. Pretend to make adjustments to the valve.
Samuel nodded, exiting swiftly.
If my interests are aligned with someone else's, I can be quite generous, Renee said. As with you. I've done my best to acquaint you gently with your circumstances. I hope you've seen that you're free to enjoy certain liberties, that you've been treated well.
Evan shifted in his chair, bringing Manny and his shotgun into view over his right shoulder. It's been lovely.
It's a lot of money to lose. I understand that. You have 72 hours to come to grips with it. But let me be clear. At the end of that time, if you don't cooperate, you won't like what will happen.
What will happen? Behind Renee, Dex stepped forward into the dim light cast by the chandelier. He'd been standing so still and silent in the shadows that until he'd moved, Evan had nearly forgotten he was present. Dex raised his left hand and pressed it across his lips. The tattoo on the back of this one was not a smile, but a bared grimace. The incisors were pronounced, not quite vampiric, though they dripped with blood. The kind of mouth that would chew right through your gut. The sight of the inked scowl held up before Dex's otherwise blank features sent a chill corkscrewing up Evan's spine. Dex had answered his question without having to speak.
Dex is mute, Renee said. Dumb, they used to call it. But I promise you that's not the case.
His teeth were tinted from the Bordeaux, the red distinct against his pasty face. He regarded Dex like a prize steer.
He manages to convey so much without saying a word.
Evan stood up. Instantly, Manny shouted at him from behind.
Siéntate! Ahora, motherfucker!
But Evan didn't sit. Instead, he kept his stare fixed on Dex. Holding his painted fangs in one place over his mouth, Dex looked back at him, his gaze containing no menace or fear. It held almost nothing at all, just the relentless focus of an owl watching a mouse about to scurry from cover.
I can see you've won some fights, Renee said. I bet you think about them from time to time. Replay them in your head.
Not as much as the ones I've lost. Renee crossed his utensils neatly upon his plate and pushed it away. From inside his lapel, he removed a clear cylindrical spray bottle. He squirted down his place setting and then rose and sprayed the cushion of his chair. He did this as though it were normal postprandial etiquette. The mysterious bottle vanished inside his jacket. He tugged the front panel, seating the coat properly on his shoulders, then flipped a button into place with an expert twist of his thumb. He nodded at Manny.
It's okay. It seems we're done.
He turned to leave. So this wire, Evan said. You think it's not traceable?
The computer is air-gapped, never been connected to the internet before. The wire will be encrypted. The receiving account will relay the money out through a series of...
Renee stopped when he saw that Evan was smiling. What about this amuses you?
That you think it's enough.
Enough for what? Evan shook his head. Trust me. You don't want to do this.
Why not?
Because, Evan said, you never know who's watching.
16. Faithful Companions.
Except for the swim cap, Candy McClure was naked. She loved being naked, though right now it was for work, not pleasure. That's why she was hunched forward, the corpse flopped atop her back, marble-white arms dangling over her shoulders as she carried it toward the conveyor belt leading to the crematory unit. The dead body pressed against her skin wasn't the most pleasant thing she'd felt this week, but she went to great lengths on disposal operations to avoid leaving fibers or residue at the scene. It was one of those pet joints. She preferred animal mortuaries to human ones. If you could get around the inevitably cutesy names, they all seemed to be called Loving Paws or Puppy Heaven. They had certain advantages, looser security being foremost. She'd broken into this outfit, faithful companions, in the glam outskirts of Muskego, because it used the Power Pack 2, her cremation unit of choice, and the same one used for humans. Nice and roomy, ideal for a St. Bernard, or an investigative reporter from the Journal Sentinel, who decided to start asking questions about black budget allocations. She flopped John Jordan's body onto the track atop a rigor mortis three-legged American Shorthair. She'd preheated the unit before retrieving the body from the stolen van she'd parked by the back loading dock. Ramming the heel of her hand into the button, she engaged the equipment and watched the unlikely twosome rumble into 1,800 degrees of obliteration. Curiosity killed the cats. Snapping her gum, she stretched out her shoulders, limboed a bit to loosen her lumbar. The flesh of her back itched and burned. John Jordan was not a small man. She caught sight of her naked form in the stainless steel of the crematory unit and paused to admire herself. A knockout body by all accounts. Large, firm breasts that still sat high and proud. Tapered waistline befitting a cello. Wide, feminine hips. Shapely legs. But she turned slowly, bringing her mottled back into view. Since Orphan X had knocked her on top of her own jugs of concentrated hydrofluoric acid, she'd had countless skin grafts and scar tissue release surgeries. The pain was intense and unremitting. Infections always one shower away. From the front, a centerfold. From behind, Freddy Krueger. Though she loathed to admit it to herself, the scarring had eaten away almost imperceptibly at her rock star confidence. Self-doubt was not her strong suit. In fact, it wasn't a trait she could remember experiencing. And yet there was something familiar in the shadows of doubt that crept beneath the repulsive surface now. Something from her early days, in which she'd more or less raised herself, emotion she'd buried out of sight, excavation deep. The question, like a whisper in her ear, are you still good enough? After all, the orphan program liked its products pristine. Candy had been perfect before. Now, she had an incontrovertible flaw, which made her human. Orphans were not supposed to be human. Beneath her swim cap, her cell phone vibrated against her skull. A girl punk band's cover of Whitney Houston's I'm Every Woman. The melody of employment. She untucked the phone and answered, yes. Is the package neutralized? The voice on the other end wasn't so much a voice as a collection of words and syllables recorded from various TV shows and commercials. Male and female, old and young, accented and not. Hashed together, the audio equivalent of an old-timey ransom note fashioned from words clipped out of different newspapers. Charles Van Sciver redefined paranoia. Though the calls were encrypted, he took this added step to dodge voice recognition software. He was a ghost, a whisper in your ear. She'd met him only once, though she hadn't seen him clearly. Not even then. She knew him mostly through second-hand stories. The upside of Orphan X's efficiency was that he had knocked out the middleman. Now she could communicate with Van Skyver directly, or at least with whatever software was proxying for his voice. She imagined him clicking away on his keyboard manically, Lon Chaney hunched over the organ in Phantom of the Opera. She flopped down the unit door to gauge the progress of the flames, a housewife checking her pot roast. The package is cooking as we speak. I have a potential lead on Orphan X, the mosaic of voices informed her. She rolled her lush lips over her teeth and bit down. Throughout the past year, there had been countless potential leads, all turning up nothing. And yet each time Van Skyver called with a juicy new morsel, her breath quickened. The only thing she found more stimulating than sex was the prospect of revenge. Orphan X had defaced approximately 40% of her glorious surface area. What got her through the excruciating surgeries, the torturous recovery periods, the needle-stab showers and sleepless nights tossing in sandpaper sheets was one thing, and one thing only. The fantasy of what she was going to do to his body when she got a hold of him. Van Skyver shared her enthusiasm. For him, too, nailing Orphan X was profoundly personal. She'd heard once that his relationship with X went back to when they were kids, but she knew nothing beyond that. That's how they had a first name, Evan. His original surname had long been abandoned. Though Evan operated now under his alias, the Nowhere Man, Van Skyver insisted on referring to him by his program code name. Van Skyver was Orphan Y. She was Orphan V. The code names bound them. With a stainless steel brush, Candy swept the remains from the crematory unit into an aluminum hopper to cool. "What's the lead?" she asked, trying to keep the eagerness from her voice. "The phone service for 18552 Nowhere was moved recently, parked at a company outside of Sevastopol." Van Skyver's data mining algorithms cast a wide net, sifting the information superhighway for network ports, VOIP soft switches, bank accounts, any red flag that might mark a trail leading back to Orphan X. "For obvious reasons, we can't get any information out of Crimea without Putin's goons catching wind," the voices continued. "I need you to go there. You'll be paired with Orphan M." Ben Jaggers, a sullen, sallow little man who looked more like a door-to-door salesman than a trained assassin. And yet she'd seen surveillance footage of him putting a chopstick through the eye of a wavering informant in a crowded Shanghai marketplace, leaving the man lobotomized over his egg-drop soup. In the program's original iteration, orphans never worked together. But for Orphan X, Van Skyver had proved willing to make exceptions. When Van Skyver had taken over operations, there'd been a shift in focus. The orphan program still occasionally carried out the bidding of the secret handshake men while allowing them full deniability. But since drone assassinations had demonstrated their click-button efficiency, there was less need of human assaulters and the complications that came with them. So a loyal corps of orphans under Van Skyver's direction now devoted themselves to hunting down wayward operatives carrying damning information in their heads. Like sharks in the womb, devouring one another until only the strongest remained. The most elusive and most dangerous of their targets was Orphan X. She dumped the remains from the hopper into the pulverizer, reducing what was left of John Jordan and Mittens to fine powder. Why Orphan M? "Because he's the only one who won't find you distracting The last pre-recorded word, spoken by a woman with an Indian accent, held particular emphasis.
Why not? Candy asked.